You are listening to the Hiking Radio Network, where we talk the walk with shows by hikers about hikers for everybody.
Mighty Blue on the Appalachian Trail, the ultimate midlife crisis. Join Steve and his guests every week as he staggers from Georgia to Maine.
Hey guys, thanks for coming back to the podcast. You've found Mighty Blue on the Appalachian Trail, the ultimate midlife crisis. We're up to episode number 371 with a fascinating guy as our main guest this week. You may even have seen Zach Cross on various media platforms in the past few weeks. He's got an extraordinary story and we've got the time to tell it. I've noticed that the TV interviews are so short and sweet, yet they barely scratch the surface of his journey over the past few years, previewing his new journey just ahead. We'll hear from Zach shortly. Our class of 2023 is at last taking a few hits, sadly. This week we hear from three of them. I won't give it away now, but we're going to be saying goodbye to somebody or somebodies today. Just so you know who we're going to hear from, first up will be Erin Conrad, whose mother left the trail after Springer while Erin continued on her own. And then, after some ridiculous technical difficulties, when I had to hold my phone up to the microphone to speak with our guest, I'm going to be speaking with Dow Shotkoski. Finally, we'll be chatting with Sonny Blackwell, who had a few issues in the Smokies. Then, in our book, Then the Hail Came, George is back to his pre-rest-at-home best, with Connecticut, his home state, easing him back onto the trail. So let's get started and introduce you all to a currently untrail-named Zach Cross. I saw a story the other day that really touched me, so I reached out to the guy in the story and invited him to come on our podcast. This is Zach Cross. Hey, Zach, thanks for doing this.
Hey, Steve, thanks for having me.
Well, funnily enough, your story has certainly had some legs recently, where you've been on the TV in several places, including speaking with CNN's Frederica Winfield quite recently. So I'm particularly pleased that you've agreed to come on and chat with me. But let's start out with telling people that you haven't hiked the Appalachian Trail or any other long-distance trail yet, but your life has been utterly transformed by hiking. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. I guess you could call me somewhat of a poser at this point until I actually do the trail. although I have done, I don't know if you count like the Art Loeb and the Foothills Trail, which are, you know, not your typical through hikes, but I technically thru-hiked them. But yeah, I was able to go on CNN, but that was kind of the culmination of a lot of other media coverage that I got recently, which has been really interesting to follow. It's not something I really expected, a month ago.
Oh, come on. You must have done. What you've achieved, looking at some of your before and after pictures. And for those of you who don't know, tell us what you did. We're going to get into why you did it, but what you've been doing for the last 2 or 3 years and what has happened to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So during COVID, like whenever the world first shut down, I kind of took a look at myself in the mirror and realized, you know, you've really let yourself go, both physically and then also just thinking about it mentally. I was not in a good spot. I was down in the dumps. I was definitely depressed. There was some dark thoughts there. But sure, physically, I was, you know, 400 pounds. And I was never a big kid. I was always a skinny kid. I was, you know, somewhat skinny in high school, college, like just an average guy. But then like my junior and senior year of college, I just put on so much weight. Just, you know, late night snacks, you know, drinking alcohol, beer, which I don't drink anymore. It just definitely
packed on the pounds. Oh my God, you gave up booze?
I have given up booze, yeah. Every now and then I'll have, you know, a Mick Ultra, which, you know, yeah, it doesn't really do any. Water essentially, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so I started to, you know, think, well, how can I make a change in a way that's not going to make me feel miserable? Because I hate going to the gym. I hate walking on a treadmill. I hate looking at the same, you know, space on a wall for 2 hours every day, just, you know, working out in that way. So I started to get into hiking and something I had never really done before. And that's kind of how I lost all the weight.
But you had no point of reference, though, did you? I mean, you say you hate doing the gym. You clearly weren't doing the gym at 400 pounds, and I'm clearly not doing the gym right now at 250 pounds. But so what was your frame of reference to think that hiking was a good idea for you then?
That's a great question. Like thinking back, there's a mountain not too far from my house that has a hiking trail. And my friend took me up there one day, like when I first started, and he was like, hey, this is a great way to get exercise. I try and do this trail every single day, and it's helped me lose, you know, 15, 20 pounds. And I was like, okay, let me give this a shot. There was like a park pass that I could get just to get in for free. And so I started hiking up it, and you know, at first it absolutely sucked. I hated the nature aspect of it because it was kind of, you know, surrounding my misery. It was kind of every time I was out there, I was miserable. I was sweaty. I was hot. I was falling down and bleeding. So the nature aspect of it didn't really appeal to me at first.
Wow. That's interesting. Yeah. How that changed. I want to take you back to that first day then. So a friend of yours suggests it's Stone Mountain, isn't it, by the way? Stone Mountain in Georgia. And how long is that hike up and down?
It's like 1 mile up, 1 mile down. It's but you very know, short.
I always say anybody gets out and does more than 200 yards, they're walking. I mean, they're walking and they're getting some benefit. But is it, and I looked at some pictures of it, and it's like an upside down bowl, isn't it? It just kind of goes up and then it's quite steep at some places. There's actually a guardrail or something, isn't it?
At the very top, there's a guardrail. It kind of reminds me of a baby version of like El Capitan in Yosemite, like kind of one of those granite monoliths. But it's definitely a pretty cool site. It's a local landmark for sure. And it's about 1,000, maybe 900 feet of gain over the whole thing. So it's pretty steep. Yeah, a mile, 900 feet. That's not an easy hike for a beginner.
And did you go... When you first did this, did you go with the friend or did you go by yourself?
First time ever was with my friend. Right. He took me up there, and then from there, it was an embarrassing thing, Steve. It was, you know, he had been doing it a lot more than I hadn't been doing it at all. He could pretty much jog up the trail, and it took me like an hour and a half. And I was just like, hey, can we stop? Hey, I need to sit down. Hey, I'm out of breath.
Sorry, I'm going to interrupt you because I interrupt people all the time. So I apologize for that.
Fine.
But yeah, but as when you're my age, you have to interrupt people because you forget what you're thinking. So take us back to that moment. What was it like, those feelings as you were going up there? Did you think this was something you were hating straight away, you were loving straight away, or you thought to yourself, this is a process to get myself feeling better about myself?
Definitely viewed it as a process. And it was in the past, whenever I was doing this kind of stuff, you know, I had given exercise somewhat of a shot, like going back to the gym and stuff like that. But when I was thinking of it like this, it definitely was a process, and a process that I thought long-term I could enjoy a lot more than traditional exercise.
Sure. And so you went up there that first day. And it took you a while to get up there. You learned a very valuable lesson then, by the way, that there is no race, is there? You can do this as long or as short as you want to do it. You know, you couldn't have done that first day. You were struggling to get up, but you got to the top. What did it feel like? Did you get to the top, by the way, the first day?
I did. It took me a while, but I eventually got up there. I was crawling at the end.
It doesn't matter. You got there. So what does that feel like? What did you feel like at the top that first day?
I remember thinking, damn, I need a milkshake. So that was definitely my first thought.
And my you didn't realize the point, did you?
Yeah. my actual thought after that was, after taking a step back, was, you know, dang, this feels really good. You know, sitting back, the wind in your hair, being able to look over the city of Atlanta skyline, which is a really cool view. It felt really good. I felt accomplished, and I felt, you know, I could do this again.
And so you did go again. And in fact, for the last 3 years, you've been doing this. And this, you say, this started in March 2020, which is when COVID hit, wasn't it? So you could that's the only way you could do is get out, is to go out hiking, I guess. And tell people how much you actually lost in that period of time, which is just, you've either had half of your body cut off or this really worked with you for exercise. So how much did you lose?
Yeah, so I was like 395, and today I'm 185. So that's like 210 pounds, something like that.
You're half the man you used to be. So
exactly.
And so did that happen pretty quickly? Because I lost 60 pounds on my first 80 hike, hike, and 50 pounds second time. So how quickly did it start moving, and did you notice it quickly?
Yeah, so this is probably the crazy part, and something that I haven't really been able to dive into too much on, like, you know, the 2 minutes I have on the news to talk about it or whatever. Yeah. The first year it poured off. I was losing, you know, probably 20 pounds a month for that first, first year. Like, wow. I was 100 pounds down by the end of 2020.
Good Lord.
And I was just like, oh, this is easy. You know, hiking is great. It's enjoyable. It's a workout, and I'm down 100 pounds. But then the you know, the wall hit, and I stopped losing weight quickly. I think my body was just kind of, it was so ready to lose weight. And then once it had lost 100 pounds, it was kind of ready to slow down. And say,
yeah, we're done.
Let's start conserving for the winter, you know. So then I hit a wall, and that, like, whenever I was first, you know, losing weight, I was kind of depressed, and that kind of helped me come out of it. But then that kind of brought that feeling back of, like, you know, I'm still looking at myself in the mirror. I'm still 300 pounds at that point. I'm still, you know, very overweight. But now I'm not losing weight as fast. Now it's down to, like, you know, a pound or two a week.
Which, by the way, is what most people recommend the maximum, don't they, really?
Yeah, that's the healthy amount. And I was not being unhealthy during that first year. I think my body was just not built to be that heavy. I think my metabolism and everything just kicked in to really help me. So after that, I hit that wall. I definitely, unfortunately, did turn to an eating disorder for like a month or two there, which was a very dark time in my life. Just trying to maintain that, that weight loss speed at which I was going at. And then, like, once I started, I was continuing to hike, and I was hiking one day and I almost, like, fainted. I was so lightheaded. Yeah. And then I realized, okay.
You were about to say lightweight, weren't you?
Yeah, lightweight. Yeah. No, I was so lightheaded, and I just realized, like, I need to get calories. This is not a healthy way to do this. And that's kind of when it snapped into my head of, like, okay, this is not going to be as easy as it has been. There's no shortcuts for this. Stop being an idiot. Stop, you know, starving yourself, and keep exercising and keep at it. And that is when, like, this really all clicked in my head. And, like, the last 100 pounds has really been like the hard part, but, like, the really, really rewarding part for sure.
Yeah. So when you first did it, the weight started dropping off, and you were starving yourself at the same time, or did you adjust your diet when you were doing this? Because you were doing the calories out bit, but were you changing your calories in, or did they get less? Or, I mean, how did you manage your diet in that period of time?
But yeah, that first year when that weight was dropping, I didn't change too much. I don't know if you are, like, if you have Southern taste, you like sweet tea in the South. So I drank a lot of sweet tea, probably a half gallon a day. And if you do the math on a half gallon of sweet tea, that's about 1,000 calories right there.
Wow.
It is really, really bad for you. So I cut that out. And then I also cut out ranch and, like, any kind of sauce. So, like, dousing my French fries in ranch, just have the French fries with, you know, ketchup. It's a little bit healthier. Or, you know, maybe instead of fast food, have a salad tonight. So I didn't do anything drastic for my diet in that first year, but I definitely, I cut out a lot of calories there for sure. I was trying to stick to about 2,000 a day.
Well, certainly it's funny, actually. I've lived in America now for about 14, 15 years, maybe a bit longer now. And certainly I remember well on TV, Oprah having lost some weight, coming on, carrying us like his trolley behind her, full of fat, and effectively blaming the weight gain on fats. But it isn't fats, is it? It's sugar. I think people have discovered since. So did you cut down on those sugars? And so your diet after you hit this wall became more sensible, or did you continue to change other things as you went on?
So once I hit the wall, that's when I started to think, like, okay, I can have, you know, 500 calories today. And that was when I got really unhealthy. So, like, that first year, just, you know, 2000, that 2 months of that second year was, like, unhealthy. That was like 500 calories a day. And once I realized that was unhealthy, I went to about 1500. There's these, like, calorie in, calorie out counters that you can use. Those were really awesome for me. And then obviously just continuing to hike, that was a really good exercise and a form of calorie out there. And then not eating your calories too is really important. Ensuring, you know, hey, I did an hour long hike today. I burned 500 calories. Let's not go and, you know, have an ice cream for dinner or for dessert to reward yourself. Let's bank those calories and save them.
Well, something you're going to find on the trail, Zach. You've already said you're going. We're going to talk about that in a sec. Something about on the trail, there's a thing called a honey bun. I seem to remember it. And anybody who's seen these and tasted them will know what I'm talking about. They're about 850 calories, this small donut type thing. So watch out for that because they're there. Yeah. They're there for people on the trail. And doing that, you know, losing all that weight as a large guy, what are the physical impacts of losing so much weight? Because I'm sure they're largely beneficial, but are there downsides as well, differences in pressures on your joints and so on, and your internal organs? You must have spoken to a doctor about this in some way, because this is, I use the expression, catastrophic weight loss, which is what lost, I felt, in the first 40 pounds in the first 5 weeks of my hike. But you've lost a lot of weight. Have you spoken to doctors about what it means to lose this weight?
So at very beginning, doctors were telling me, you know, Zach, you are, at the time I was like 25 years old. They're saying, Zach, if you don't lose weight, you're not looking at a long lifespan here. You're looking at best like type 1 diabetes in your 30s, type 2 diabetes. Sorry. And that's something that runs in my family. And I'm just like, how can I be thinking about, you know, having this condition that, like, at the time I'd associated, you know, with older, bigger guys. I'm 25 and I'm being told that's my future. And then, yeah, like other hugely impactful things, like not being able to find clothes that fit ever, always hating the way you look, not being able to go on like stuff like not being able to go on rides at like theme parks with your friends. There was one time we went to on a roller coaster at Universal Studios, and they were trying to pull the lap bar over me. And they said, no, you got to come sit in this special seat. And they like pulled me back to the back of the ride. And there's like this special seat that has like three buckles that like make it so it can fit over me. And I was just like, it was embarrassing because they had to stop the ride. And like I felt like everyone was looking at me. In hindsight, it was probably not a huge deal. People probably didn't care. But that's an embarrassing thing to have happen. And that like definitely affects your psyche more than anything.
Sure. And could you fly?
not pleasurably. There was definitely not a fun. It was not fun to fly. You know, I usually had to get a seat next to me to have like that extra space. If I didn't, then I would usually get, you know, dirty looks, or it's like, oh god,
you're the guy. But I'm sitting in an aisle seat, and there's somebody in the window seat, and there's an empty seat next to me. Big guys walking. I mean, I'm a big guy anyway myself. Big guys walking down the aisle, thinking, please don't be here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I had to fly Southwest a lot too, because, you know, the seats, you can pick your own seat, and usually people wouldn't sit next to me, which was nice. So unless it was a full plane,
that's pretty cool. Yeah. And what about the mental benefits of doing this hiking? Have people, your wife, for instance, did she notice you changing in other than physical ways? Did she see a difference in attitude, in confidence, and so on?
Oh, I'm sure she did. Absolutely. I don't think that I'm the same person at all. I don't think there's even like 10 to 15% of who I was at that point mentally. I was just such a different person. Like, my happiness level these days is completely off the charts from where I was. Like, for my entire life, I feel like I didn't have my niche or my passion or the thing that drove me. And I think I discovered it. And like, I think I found the thing that's going to drive me for the rest of my life, which is, you know, hiking mainly, but also just like being outdoors, being in nature. The long distance aspect of hiking is going to be something I'm really interested to see how that changes me too, obviously. But I definitely have just become such a happier person these days.
Yeah, Steve. Your love of nature. You probably didn't, as you said, you probably didn't notice it the first couple of days when you were going up there. You were just trying to survive. But so how does that manifest itself, the love of nature? Because if you've been doing the same hike every day for three years, and it was virtually every day once you got started, wasn't it?
Even if I had to go at 11 o'clock at night, I would do it.
Oh, really? Wow, I bet that's cool. And so loving nature, how did that manifest itself? What were you seeing in nature that you hadn't really appreciated before?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's just like whenever you're out there, and I'm sure you've experienced it too, when you just, you know, the sun is hitting your face and the warmth of the wind is in the air and there's birds chirping and there's squirrels running across your path and you can hear the leaves crunching underneath your feet. There's just this intrinsic happiness that it's hard to really describe unless you're a nature lover, that just kind of washes over you. I think inherently deep down, humans are meant to be in nature. I think in the last, you know, 150 years, we've probably lost a lot of that. But I think we come from nature. We are, you know, natural beasts at heart, I believe. And yeah, there's just something about it. There's something inherently about it.
You know, I totally agree. And in fact, so much so that I knew I was speaking with you today and I didn't really know how to approach you. In fact, you know, we only communicated, we're only going to have an initial conversation, but I got right in my mind what I wanted to talk about. So I put these questions down and said, can we speak today? And I went for a walk myself. First time for about a week and a half that I've gone for a walk outside. And I felt that feeling of an exhalation, which I always feel when I do go outside. I mean, I was going through a local community, so I wasn't exactly immersed in nature, but there were a little path was winding along and there were a few little birds around, animals around, and that sound of nature and being outside was so lovely. But you did that Stone Mountain thing. Oh, by the way, also saw this morning looking at Stone Mountain. Was it an April Fool's or was it actually a part of the Olympics? An Olympic site?
It was.
I thought, I wanted the picture. Is that real or not?
Yeah, they did the archery at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta there, and they did some kind of cycling event there. And there's a songbird meadow that they turned it into, which is absolutely beautiful. It's one of my favorite parts of Stone Mountain to walk around.
Nice. Sounds nice. And why didn't you quit? You know, what was it that kept you going? Was this the realization that you were going to get diabetes unless you carried on? You felt this was your last chance? Because this was voluntary. You didn't have to do this, did you? And you must have sweat buckets, I suspect. What made you just carry on?
I mean, there was never really even crossed my mind to quit. I was enjoying what I was doing. I mean, yeah, it was hard, but I enjoyed the hiking so much that it didn't seem like quitting was an option. To quit would be to say, I don't want to do this thing I'm passionate about anymore.
Right. So you gain this passion. We're going to jump ahead now because you are actually starting the AT. And you're starting on May the 1st. And we're speaking now on April the 6th. So why May the 1st? That's quite late for a through hike. Have you thought about, was there a particular reason for May the 1st?
Yeah, I wish I could leave a little bit sooner. But I read, I don't know, I'm sure you've heard of, you know, AWOL's book. He left like late-ish April. So like it can be done. I know for a fact that it can be done. But the two reasons are truthfully, one, my sister's getting married the week before I leave and I have to be there for that. And then two, we already have tickets to see Taylor Swift in concert the day before I leave. So I have to go to that. So those are the two reasons.
That's very good. That'd be cool. See Taylor Swift. How cool is that?
The last thing I do before walking into the woods is going to be seeing Taylor Swift, which will be kind of a weird thing.
You'll be singing all those songs all the time.
Yeah.
So there you are with this last 3 years. You're going up and down Stone Mountain. You're really enjoying it. You've got the passion there. When did the thought of a through hike start to hit you, and how did you embrace that thought? Because it's not a natural transition, you know. And your story is remarkable in many ways. And if you can complete this, it'll be a bloody miracle, to be honest with you. Because, well, no, it is for everybody. Great thing to achieve. So, from where you were, literally 3 years ago today, to the thought of going on a through hike is amazing. So, when did that thought hit you, and what made you think, well, I think I'm going to do the Appalachian Trail? What was it that gave you that feeling?
Yeah. So it was about a year ago when I first I'd always heard, you know, like the Appalachian Trail is a thing. And I live in Atlanta, which is an hour from, you know, Springer Mountain. So it's hard not to have heard about it here. But when I first heard about people who through hike this trail, I thought, oh, like, they're crazy. They're like, how can people do this? They're idiots. And then I got this like worm in my head of like, oh, I mean, that actually sounds kind of cool. And then when I first went on my first ever backpacking trip, we did Standing Indian, which is right there in the Nonhala National Forest, south of the NOC, I believe.
Yep.
Beautiful, beautiful trail. We did it in fall, and it was my first ever like real backpacking trip. And we were at a campfire one night when this guy came around. His name was Shakespeare. And he was a AT through hiker. I believe he did it in 2015 or 2016. He did it southbound. And he came and he just talked about it with us. He's like, yeah, I through hiked the trail. And I was able to talk to him for about 15, 20 minutes while he just hung out by our campfire. And he told us that he did it because his brother had passed away recently. And he just needed to like do something, you know, big. And the trail was his way of doing that. And that stuck with me for months. Like, I could not stop thinking about that encounter. And then I started researching, I started reading books about it, and it just, the earworm just wouldn't go away. It was all I could think about. So I started making this plan to do it in 2022, last year. And yeah, it's kind of been going to come to fruition this year.
I bet you're excited, man. Every person I speak to on this trial, so I've got this class of Mighty Blue class of 23, and there are 15 of them who are going to go this year, and I keep in touch with them all the way up the hike. And I'm excited for all of them being out there. I'm excited for you as well. What does your wife think about it? I'm going to say that because my listeners know I think this is very important to get support from home. Is she supportive? Is she worried?
She is so supportive. I could not ask for a better wife in this regard. But to give a little context, you kind of have to understand who I am as a person, where when I get my mind set on something, it's really, really, really hard to talk me out of it, almost like debilitating to me. So my wife kind of knows, like, okay, Zach, he wants to do this thing. If he doesn't do it, then he's going to be, he's going to not upset, but he's going to be like not himself until he does it. And so she kind of realizes, you know, he needs to do this. He needs to get this thing done. And yeah, that's kind of where we're at. She's being very supportive. And
Will she come and visit you out on the trial?
Yeah. So we live in Atlanta. So she's going to come. I think she's going to come visit me like the first three weekends for sure. Hot Spring, North Carolina. She wants to come up. And then we have family in Charlotte, North Carolina, too. Nice. I'll have family close by. Up through Damascus, pretty much.
And how are you managing to do this with work? Because I guess you've got a mortgage and all the other stuff that goes with being married. Is this something you've able to work out with your business you work with?
Yeah, so I work for a tech startup, and they are absolutely being phenomenal about this. I brought up the idea to my boss about doing the trail, and she was very supportive.
How heavy were you when you brought that idea up? Because she probably didn't take you seriously if you were quite a big girl.
This was about 3 months ago.
Oh, right.
So she was very supportive. And I think at first she was maybe just a little bit like, oh gosh, like, because it's just me and my boss on our team. I work in HR. And she's like, how are we going to do this? But then, you know, I think once she realized that I was really serious about it, she said, you know, Zach, we want you to do this. And they're being very supportive. They want to, whenever my story went like viral on CNN for the first time, she brought up like, we want to actually like share that and like use that as a, like as marketing for our company, because like, this is really cool. So
that is so cool. And after those various TV appearances, and now what you've told me about your boss and your colleague and so on, I know you've had a lot of positive messages, and you've talked about it on your YouTube channel. What do you take from those messages? Are they driving you on?
It's been unreal. I've probably got easily like 3,000 or 4,000 comments in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and it's crazy how many people are like, oh, you've inspired me to, you know, start hiking, or you've inspired me to lose weight. And I did not necessarily set out to do this journey with that in mind. I just wanted to hike this trail, you know. But the fact that, you know, my journey north to Maine could have impacts on people's lives outside
totally,
of my own.
Totally.
That's so cool. Because
I totally agree.
Yeah. I mean, through hiking is somewhat of a selfish endeavor. I mean, you're on the trail for 5 months. You're away from your family, from society. You kind of are asking a lot of the people who you leave behind for when you're on the trail. So like, you kind of feel guilty about that. But then the fact that I'm able to kind of turn it around and put other people's, you know, perspectives and feelings and inspirations on my back, like, it's a heavy burden to carry, but it's a really cool one to carry.
Well, I was going to ask you that. With all this exposure, do you feel like you've added a burden of expectation on yourself? Because that's quite a lot in many ways. You know what I mean? It's kind of quite a lot to carry, because a lot of people really want you to do this now. So how are you going to manage that? Or are you just going to say, this is my endeavor for me to do this, and if it works out, great, I'll do it. If it doesn't, well, that's the way it goes.
Yeah. I mean, Steve, I'll be honest. There's no way I can't have a little bit of trepidation about the amount of pressure on me now. There's definitely a lot of people who are going to be watching me that wouldn't have been before.
Sure.
So, I mean, I'm going to give it my best shot. There's right now, I mean, like people never set out on a thru hike with the intention of quitting, and I don't either.
Right.
Like right now, there's zero doubt in my mind that I'm going to make it. But if for whatever reason, like I cannot continue, let's say I get hurt or just I'm miserable. I mean, HYOH, hike your own hike. I'm doing this for me, and hopefully my message already enough of, you know, hiking to get in shape will have inspired people, even if I don't finish the trail. But that doesn't matter because I'm going to do it. So
I think what you didn't need the last sentence, but good for you for saying that. But you're absolutely right. I can see this must inspire people. I've seen people commenting on your Facebook page, so it's fantastic. I was a bit concerned about the expectations. So in terms of the expectations of you, what are your expectations of a thru hike?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, everyone's hike, I feel like, is different, especially me starting a little bit later. I didn't necessarily want to be like a bubble hiker. I didn't want to necessarily get super lost into the social element of the trail. I'm really doing it because I feel like the solitude and nature aspect of it is really cool. However, I don't want to be completely alone. So I'm hoping to get a lot of time to reflect. There's like in the last year, I've just really had a lot of questions about like who I am, what's in my future, purpose of life stuff,
to get
like a little bit deep with it. But I've had a lot of questions about that, and I'm hoping to discover a little bit about that. And then also the human spirit, like how far can we push ourselves? What does it feel like to be pushed to that breaking point? Because, I feel like I have been pushed pretty close to that in the last 3 years since I started losing weight. But like, how much more of a breaking point can I achieve? Like, I want to challenge myself in that regard. So that should be fun. And then, yeah, I mean, the AT is the most beautiful, some of the most beautiful land in the entire world, with so many cool sights to see. And I've never been up to the Northeast before. So that should be cool. So just like the travel element of it, it's going to be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I say, you have a YouTube channel, which we'll put a link in the show notes.
Thank you.
And you've taken these positive messages. Are you going to be vlogging on the trail, try to do it most days or once a week, or how are you going to do it? Because I can tell you from personal experience, I just did a podcast from the trail and it was exhausting because at the end of every day you're knackered, you know, so
yeah.
you do get tired. But I think it's all, and I tell people this all the time, you really need to keep a record of this because it does blur otherwise into one thing, one amorphous thing. Are you keeping a daily vlog? What are you going to do?
So I'm definitely going to, and by the way, the podcast sounds like a much smarter thing than I was planning on doing, but I was definitely going to do for sure a spreadsheet, just, you know, charting my daily mileage, where I stopped, like where I stayed, like just some quick notes. I mean, I don't know if that would be something I would ever look back on or be helpful in the future, but I think it is good to do. But then in terms of deeper stuff, I'm probably going to start journaling on my phone. I'm not like a good writer with pen and paper, but I'll probably just like jot some few notes of what happened that day, thoughts I had in my phone. And then I would love to do a vlog every day, at least, you know, maybe 5 to 10 minutes of lightly edited, just like, here's what I'm seeing, here's what I'm thinking. Just kind of walk along with me for a little bit. And I have like an app on my phone that I can edit with that I've been practicing with. I have like a GoPro. So the only thing that will stop me from doing that is going to be battery, obviously, and just not being able to consistently post.
Yes.
And if I get, you know, too tired of carrying too much weight, I may just throw my GoPro into a lake. So
you're a tech guy. You work it out. Don't worry about all that.
Yeah.
You'll be fine. And interestingly, when I was trying to work out some questions for today, you already expect, I think this is in one of your interviews, you already expect to change again on your hike. Have you thought about how that may be? Because almost be careful what you wish for. You know what I mean? You know, you feel totally transformed from the person you were 3 years ago. This is such an intense thing in your case for 5 months, in my case for 6 months. What are you're prepared, you're open, I presume, to everything. Have you thought about how this might impact you?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be hard not to. I think that the way I'm going to approach it is kind of like a river that is just pounding against rocks, you know, over the course of time, changing the flow of it slightly. I'm kind of thinking about it like that, where you don't necessarily think about how it's changing you. And then you kind of, over the course of the whole trail, I'll probably be able to look back and see like, okay, like this is how I'm different. just like a gentle river over the course of time. So I don't necessarily want to be changed, but I'm going to allow it to change me if that's what it does.
So, and you're going to allow yourself to be named, or you're going to go on the trail with a trail name, because you know, you're going to have one at some stage.
Yeah. I definitely don't want to pick my own trail name. I'll be bestowed upon one. But on that, I also think that a lot of people, you know, they're so eager to get a trail name that they'll pick one up on the approach trail, and it will be like, oh, I'm Big Rock because I walked by a big rock, and someone said, hey, look at that big rock. So I want to like get one that actually has meaning to me. Sticks with it.
Yeah, you could be the 50% man. You lost 50%. You're right. There you go. Well, look, I'm in awe of what you've done, and I love the fact that you look so positive. People can't see you, we're just doing the audio, but you look so positive and happy. I just wish you so well, and I just ask you if you can check in with me for 10 minutes halfway through or something like that, and then come on the trail at the end on the show when you finish and tell us how it went.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love that, Steve.
Okay, man. Well, look, I really appreciate you coming on, and best of luck. Enjoy it. Happy trails.
Thank you. Happy trails, my friend.
Cheers, then. Bye. Well, that's quite a story, and what an articulate teller of his story. When we spoke off mic, he told me he'd enjoyed the conversation because he was able to talk about so much more than the TV interviews had allowed. That's why I love this format. I thought he was such an inspirational advocate of hiking and being in nature. Basically, nature pretty much saved Zach's life, and I thought it was good to see how those initially little steps and those short hikes had prepared him to take on the AT. Now, we all know it's not going to be easy, but Zach must feel that if he's lost 200 pounds, he's certainly got a shot. While he's not part of our class of 23, I'll definitely be following along with his progress when he starts next Monday. So let's now turn to our class of 23. First up, we're going to hear from Erin Conrad. She hadn't reached out to me for some time, so I was a little bit concerned when we spoke. Here's Erin. Well, we're back on with Erin Conrad. I don't know if you recall that Erin started with her mother, but her mother went home pretty quickly. Hey, Erin, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. I'm disappointed for you because I know you wanted to do this and you're now back home. So, and some, you told me something which I don't recall you telling me before. You were actually diagnosed with Lyme disease the day before you and your mother started. Is that right?
Yes. I was feeling not so well. I actually lost use of my hands.
Oh my God.
I have carpal tunnel, so it basically just exacerbated the carpal tunnel in my hands. And I'd had a tick bite and it had a huge bullseye. And I thought, oh my, here we go. So I went to the doctor the day before we left and she's like, yes, you have Lyme's disease. Put me on doxycycline and, cautioned me to stay out of the sun. And I said, well, we get ready to go hike a trail.
Yes. So
there's lots of sun.
What did your doctor say to that?
She's known I was going. And so she was very apprehensive about my mother and I going. Sure. And she was scared for us, but she's also family. So she was extra. Yeah.
So your mother went home fairly early. She was obviously struggling with it. So what was your mindset once she'd gone home?
I actually didn't realize that when we went together, my mindset in the beginning was, is this going to be something that holds me back? And are we going to get along on trail was a big thing. but we got along fantastic. And actually, once she left, my first mindset was, okay, now it's my time to shine. And I felt extra light with my steps. And I was like, yes, I'm going to conquer this trail. And then as the days went on, I realized she really was my why for being there.
Oh, really?
I went from being her caregiver, you know, constantly watching her and helping her. And then when she left, I became the one that received care. I formed a trail family and they were watching after me. And I'm like, oh, I don't like this position I'm in.
So were you? You said you met a trail family and they were looking out for you. Were you struggling physically at that time?
At first, it was going mom's pace. I was doing amazing. I didn't, you know, we would go 20, 30 feet, take a small break. And there was just this constant slow pace. And so my body never felt anything. Right. There was no soreness, nothing. And then after she left, I just went full force, which was an absolute mistake. And both my knees, every time I try to go down a hill, my knees would just give out. There was a lot of pain in my knees, my right foot. I believe now I have a bunion. There's a protruding area to my right big toe. And it, still to this day, it's pretty painful to walk sometimes, but my body was not prepared.
So say that. Yeah, you know what, people find that, but I think if they keep going, that they find the physicality will, most of them will get there. But you've done some hikes beforehand. Had you had problems with the downhills beforehand?
No, actually my husband had made that point when I came home. Because he kept telling me, oh, you need to go on this week long trip and see what you're getting yourself into. And I told him, with what we have in our area, I could have been out there for a month and it would never compare to the Appalachian Trail. The AT is straight up, straight down, straight up, straight down. And where we're at, it's just kind of a nice stroll compared to the AT.
So being back home, we'll come to that in a minute. So you say you were determined to keep going. You met a trail family or something. But then you said in the next sentence, when the message you sent me, no sleep, no appetite, and constantly battling dehydration. My body was beat down. Well, you knew about dehydration. You knew you got to drink water. Did you fight? Was that a shock to you, how dehydrated you got?
It actually was, because I was consuming probably 3 to 4 liters of water a day, and it just never seemed to be enough.
Sure.
And the weather was a huge factor for myself, my mother, everybody we were hiking with. We were sleeping in 16 degree weather, freezing, raining. Mom actually at one point started showing signs of hypothermia.
Wow.
And
that's worrying. Yeah.
That was very scary. And she was trying to, I mean, she was a champ. She really kept going, but you could tell there was something wrong. And she would start just talking out of her head. You'd see her spacing off, and
wow.
I'm like, Mom, are you with me? And she'd say, yeah. And then she'd just say random things like, yeah, it's blue. And I'm like, what's blue?
Oh, dear. And,
but we were able to get her to a shelter, get dry clothes on. I was making her something hot to eat and drink, and she was able to recover by the next day. But then we woke up with everything frozen.
Of course you did, yeah. But, you know, I know you wouldn't regard it as a burden, but once you had relieved yourself of the – and it is a burden looking out for somebody else, and whether it's a child, a parent, even just a friend. Once you were without that burden, you said you had that – you wanted to carry on, you were going to really take it on and so on. But that no sleep and no appetite, none of that helps either. So was it because you weren't used to sleeping in a tent, or – were you in a tent or hammock, by the way?
We were in a tent, and when it really just came down to the weather, it was so cold. I counted it up in 5 days. I had less than 5 hours of sleep.
Oh, geez.
And it was just so cold. You couldn't get comfortable enough to fall asleep.
Wow.
Or once you did fall asleep, you woke up shivering. And
were you wearing, did you wear all your clothes in bed or in your sleeping bag?
All the dry ones I had.
All right. Crikey. Yeah, of course. And so your mother went, when did she go home? Where were you?
We got to Springer Mountain, and she had told me on our way up Springer Mountain, she said, I think I'm going to get hurt if I stay. Mm. And I couldn't disagree with her. She had already fallen twice before that moment. And, I said, well, it's definitely your choice. And we shared lots of tears. It was quite an emotional adventure for us as mother and daughter. And so then we got to the top of Springer Mountain and we found a ridge runner. Mary was her name. And she's like, okay, you guys need to get to Springer Mountain shelter, stay the night and just regroup.
Yes.
Well, it was like an 18 degree night and no worse, you know, your appetite. That was something that really surprised me was I love to eat. And when you get out on trail, food is the last thing you want to even think about. And, but I think a lot of that could have also been the Lyme's disease and taking the antibiotics.
Sure,
it caused
sure.
a lot of GI upset. And so then we stayed the night and the next morning I hear her listening to a voice message from my dad. And he's like, I can't remember the town, Ellijay, maybe Georgia. He said, I'm at the Ace Hardware in Ellijay. He said, when you get here, you know, I'm waiting for you. And so as soon as he heard word that she was thinking about going home, he hops in the car and he drives all the way to Georgia through the night.
Of course he does.
And came and got her. So we ended up, you know, getting our pictures at the top of Springer Mountain and touching the first white blaze. And then we are headed down to the
parking lot.
Can't even remember what it's called.
Well,
the parking lot. Yeah,
yeah.
And she had another fall and that fall was more severe than any of the other ones. And she did hurt herself. Nothing major, but it was pretty hard for her to walk after that and got a shuttle to come. And so then off she went.
So how far did you get eventually? How much longer were you on trail?
I actually only went two more nights on trail.
Right.
I stayed at Stover Creek that first night. Sure. It was 16 degrees and I learned very fast. You never stay in a shelter when it's cold and windy and you never, ever stay at the top of a shelter. did not sleep that entire night. Just laid there and shivered. But woke up the next morning and I was like, man, even freezing to death, I'm still having fun.
Yeah.
And then, so we took off that next morning and made it to Hawk Mountain Shelter. And that's when I started realizing my body was in a lot of pain and I just was not coping well.
Mm-hmm. Did you make the decision to get off then? Or because you weren't near an exit at that stage, were you?
No, we stayed at Hawk Mountain Shelter and then made it to Cooper Gap the next day. Mm-hmm. And I'd already had a stay scheduled with the Hidden Pond Hostel. And so the two guys I was hiking with, they're like, well, we'll stay with you. You know, we could use them a day off after all that weather we've had.
Sure.
And so then when I got to the hostel, I still hadn't even made up my mind or even thought about leaving. But then I called my mom and that was all I could think about was I want to get home.
Yeah.
And I tried really hard to, you know, change my mindset and think about, you know, never quit on a bad day. So I decided to take a zero. And as day hikers, but they were doing slack packing, they would come back and they're all excited and telling me about their trip for the day. And I'm just sitting there thinking, I have zero desire to move forward. And the only thing I could think about was how to get a flight home.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe this isn't for you then, you know, you never know. And I know that you got home just in time as your grandmother was placed in hospice. You know what, there's a downside to all these things, but that's a massive upside. You had the opportunity to spend some time with your grandmother at that stage, I suspect.
Yes, it absolutely was. And the fact that I wasn't working, I was able to spend every single night with her and I was with her when she passed. Mm. And so I'm very grateful that I had that opportunity to be with her in her last hours and days. So.
I'm sure you did. I'm sure you did. Now, you ended the text, which was drastically, perhaps over-optimistic at this stage. you said, I see a second attempt in my future with many lessons learned. And the short amount of trail left me with a great deal of insight to myself. So what did it give you about yourself you didn't know was there?
I would say probably just confidence in myself. You know, I am my worst enemy and my worst critic. And I don't generally build myself up in any kind of positive way. Mm-hmm. I just I'm very negative to myself. But when we were climbing one day and it took everything in me, every single step, I'm chugging along and all I can hear in my mind is, you're amazing. You're doing this. You're awesome. You're, you know, you're better than you ever thought you were. And so to even just hear myself talk to myself that way, it was like, wait a second, I can be my own best friend and, you know, build myself up. And really, I think a lot of what got me into going to the AT in the beginning was probably pride driven. And the fact, and honestly, a lot of the stupid mistakes I've made in life are pride driven. And the fact that a short period of time, I said, I don't care what anybody thinks about me. I'm going home and I'm not going to regret the time I've been here. And so that was a big lesson for me as well, to make a decision for myself and not what others are going to think.
An important lesson learned, certainly. And the trial does that to a number of people as well. So it's thinking about it now, and how long ago was it you went home?
It's been a good month now. I've been in hiding.
You didn't reach out to me, did you?
No.
You knew I was going to come call it at some stage, didn't you?
Yeah, I just, it was a lot to process. I almost feel like like when I got home, I just would sit there and space out and like relive moments on trail and there, it was just a lot to take in. Sure. Coming home. And
are you actively planning on getting back there, or is this something you think may happen in the future, or are you actually missing the trail every day?
I miss the people.
Yeah. That's a common refrain, missing the people. Most people do miss the people, but it's whether or not you miss the day-to-day work, knowing that that would have to increase as time went on every day if you're going to get there to the end. Is your ambition muted a little bit, or do you think that ambition is still there to get back there?
I would say it's muted a little bit. I mean, if you recall from our first interview together, my why for getting into through hiking was to escape a abusive marriage.
Sure.
And I did all of that on my own. And my husband had pointed out to me, you know, you're going to have to figure out your why. And so as mom and I would make plans, I never really thought about my why. It was more, I'm here for her. And it wasn't until after she left, I'm like, I have no idea why I'm here. So now I feel like my why, if I was to go again, would just be to prove that I can do it. And I'm not ready to do that just yet.
Okay. Well, look, you know, I've heard this. I've heard people eventually realizing that this isn't necessary for them. This is not a walk in the park, as they say. and I think it's something that, you know, you've actually done more than 99.9% of Americans, and you actually went through that arch. So that was a start. You proved you could get on the trail. It's tough to stay on the trail, and none of it's easy. And it plays in your head. It gets progressively worse unless you can pull yourself out of that funk you feel when you're on the trail. So look, I appreciate you being part of the class of 23, and I know it wasn't easy to come back on. So, and thanks for doing that, and say hi to your mum for me, will you?
I sure will.
Okay. Thanks a lot then. Cheers. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Oh my gosh, she found out she'd lied the day before she and her mother left for the trail. To be fair, the odds were stacked against her from the very start. Yet she seemed kind of upbeat about that time out there and even identified some positives she took away. Are we going to see her out there again? I don't know. But I do know that at least she walked through that arch, which ain't nothing. Just before we hear from Dale Shutkoski, I wanted to remind you all that this weekend our $100 discount for our Woods Hole Weekend video series is going away. You still got time, so if you've been thinking about making an investment in your own hike, then now's the time to sign up. You can find it on the hikingradionetwork.com website, as others have done. Don't miss out. Now let's catch up with Dale Shutkoski. Here's Dale. Okay, well, we're on after massive technical difficulties. I'm literally holding the microphone up to my own So I'm literally holding my phone up to my microphone, listening to Dale Shotkoski. Hey, Dale, how are you?
I'm doing okay, but I'm technically challenged.
Well, I think we're both technically challenged at the moment. But how long have you been on trail now, Dale?
I've been doing well. I've really, really enjoyed it. I got off trail today at Dick's Creek and went into Hiawassee to do laundry, take a shower, resupply, and I found myself a few minutes ago wanting to pack my bag to see how soon I could get out tomorrow morning because I'm kind of bored in the hotel.
Right, I know what you mean.
I wanted to get back out there.
When did you actually start? When was your first day?
April 11th. And I started at Amicalola, the approach trail.
Yeah.
And that was a very, very long day for me because I woke up at 3 a.m. to catch a flight out of Omaha to Atlanta.
Oh, dear.
Got into Atlanta, had a great shuttle driver, Ron, from the AT shuttle. He's a big fan of yours, Steve.
Oh, that's cool.
He was very nice. He even cached water at different places for us and gave me tips on where to water and where the dry spots were. So he got me off to a very good start.
Yeah.
But that first day was a very long day. I tell you, that approach trail is very hard.
So you sent me a few notes and you said that you saw a bear. When was that?
That was this morning.
On
our walk into Dick's Creek. We just had a 2.6-mile little walk into Dick's Creek to catch a shuttle. And about 1 mile in to our hike this morning, there was three of us, and we saw a bear just running through the woods.
Amazing.
We ran so fast, we weren't even able to get our cameras out. But we all three of us saw it.
Yeah. And you also mentioned, which is a bit disturbing, that the people are great, but there's been a theft at a shelter. Are you sure that it's been a theft or somebody hasn't mislaid something?
No, there at Gooch Gap Shelter, there were six food bags stolen out of a bear box the night before we went in. And the Ridge Runner, very nice Ridge Runners that I've met along the trail so far, but Ridge Runner Tom went to the shelter that night to tell us all about it, to try to calm our fears because it was on all over the Far Out app. And I actually met two of the people who had their bags stolen. And sadly for one of them, his prescription pills and things like that were also stolen, so they had to get off and find cook stoves, everything.
That is so irresponsible, though, isn't it? But, you know, you know how much people need, obviously, medication. To just go and take their food bags, that is just despicable stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, that really was a wake-up call for all of us to watch who were hiking around and to kind of stay with somebody that you kind of got to know a little bit on the trail.
So sure.
Every night after that, I either paired up or there was a group of three of us that would kind of go to campsites even more than shelters, just out of a sense of safety.
I'm sad that it's happened to you so early. I never had any incident like this, and don't know whether the country's getting worse or there's just this prevalence of lack of respect for people's belongings. But that is so sad and bloody dangerous, to be honest with you. So I hope they catch whoever it is, but I suspect they probably won't. And maybe it's a bunch of kids just jerking around, which is not a great thing. So what about the trail itself? Have you enjoyed being on the trail itself?
Yes, I really do. I've found that every day that I've been out there, I'm liking it more and more. Yesterday, I was getting fatigued. I did a 13-mile day the day before, which was above what I wanted to do.
Sure.
But just did it. And so I was feeling fatigued, but I knew I was going to have a down day today to rest up. So everything's fine. I had really feared feet issues early on, and so far so good. I mean, it's been great. And so the shorter days are getting my feet, I think, toughened up to it, used to it, the weights and everything, the weight of the pack. So
sure.
It's good. It's good. It's very enjoyable.
And what about the people? You've obviously, you've expected certain things on the trail, and you've told me that disappointing story about, obviously, somebody stealing the food bags. But is the experience as you imagined it would be? Because, you know, you've listened to the show for a while, so you know people always say that the people on the trail are so great, and they generally are. What has the experience itself been like?
Oh, the positive people far outweigh the negative incident. I mean, I've met people from the UK, Australia, New Zealand. It's amazing. I'm a slow hiker, so as people pass by, they stop and visit a little bit, say a few words, or at shelters or at water stops, you just visit with people. We were counting up the states. Another guy I was hiking with for a while, we were already over 30 states from the United States that people were from on the trail.
Wow.
Along with multiple other countries. And so it's, and almost everyone you meet out there is just happy to be there.
I'm sure.
And very encouraging.
And have you got a trail name yet?
No, I do not. No, I do not.
Have you done anything? Have you done anything stupid yet?
I'm sure I have. For a while, I was hiking. Everyone I was hiking with were probably younger than my children, and just out of courtesy, I think a lot of them were just calling me Mr. Dale. And so for a while, that was just out of courtesy. It wasn't meant to even be a trail name. But after a while, people started saying, "Hey, have you seen Mr. Dale?" That's not a true trail name yet. That was just a courtesy thing because I was hiking with a 24-year-old, a 33, and a 29-year-old, and we were just hanging out, and they just all started calling me that.
That's the best thing of it. It's that whole thing of all being together. It doesn't matter your age. It's terrific. And so you've actually mentioned that many people you started with are already off trail. I know that's a regular thing, but nobody's actually said that to me this year. So what were the different reasons for getting off trail? Or do they just disappear?
No, I've actually received texts from different people I started with. And one gentleman I hiked with for several days, he really, really, really started breaking down bad. He wasn't able to eat, wasn't able to drink.
Oh, wow.
And he got off at Neil's Gap. He just, it was too much, you know, and he went to seek some medical attention, and he hopes to get back on, according to his last text, when he recovers.
Mm.
But we'll see. Another person, feet issues and stomach issues, just took him off. He returned back to Colorado. So, I mean, sadly, that's just, it's a hard trail. It's very difficult. And if you think it's going to be an easy walk in the park, it's not.
Yeah, that book, I know it's terribly unpopular with a lot of people, but very popular with other people, A Walk in the Woods. It is not a walk in the woods, is it?
It is a climb and descending in the woods. At my age, I find the descent sometimes as challenging as the ascents. The ascents can tire you out, but the descents is where I kind of, that's where the fear and the danger comes in, and the carefulness of each step has to be considered.
You're going to find that even worse. You'll find that even worse. Further north, you're going to find that even worse. But that's the great thing, I think, about the way the trail's been set up. You're ready for it by the time it hits you in the north. So, you know, I think you'll be trained up for it. So what's the plans next couple of days? Where are you going to be?
I hope to hit the trail and be in North Carolina in 2 days.
Nice.
And my next stop will probably be at the NOC. I got enough resupply to go all the way to the NOC.
Right.
Today, and that's my plan. I was thinking about Franklin, but kind of like being out on the trail right now, and as slow as I'm going with my miles, I don't want to take too many town days.
No, and you know what? Don't worry about being slow. You will speed up, or you won't speed up. That's fine. But you know, you'll get there, and just keep going and keep one foot in the other. And we're going to work out this technical issue, because this is a real pain in the ass for you, I'm sure. So we'll work this out, and there may be a blocker you've got on there. But anyway, look, it's great to hear from you. Great to hear you going. I'm sorry we had this issue, but, you know, we've at least spoken. So I'll catch up with you in a couple of weeks, okay?
And I'll let you know, Steve, I've met other people along the way who have asked, do you ever listen to Mighty Blue? And I told him, yes, I do. And one guy actually said he recognized me from a picture he saw on the internet.
Good
so
Lord.
He must also be a listener of yours. So good you Lord. Do have fans out on the trail.
That's nice. That's real nice. Okay, man. Well, look, good talk to you. Okay. And stay safe out there. Right.
All right. Thank you so very much.
Cheers then. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Blimey. Getting your food bag stolen must really suck. It's hard for me to countenance that. And I always go on about how special the community is out on trail, because frankly, that was what I experienced both times. Clearly, as in all walks of life, there are scumbags. And sadly, there must be one out on the AT, possibly even still. Let's hope that he or she gets off soon. But even with that in his early days, Mr. Dale is having a blast. And he's noticed the trail thinning out a bit, which is pretty normal, of course. Let's hope that Dale keeps on trucking. The third member of our class of 23 is Sonny Blackwell, who we also haven't heard much from. So when he wrote to me the other day, I kind of worked out why. Here's Sonny. So, on today's show, we're catching up with somebody we haven't heard from for a little while, Sonny Blackwell. Hey, Sonny, how are you?
I'm better now, Steve, but doing well.
Better now, but doing well. Now, you sent me a text when I asked about recording, and you said that I have to go to a physical therapy appointment. By that statement, I'm obviously off trail. So, what happened?
While I was going through the Smokies, I started developing some upper back pain. So,
right.
Okay, Advil and some rest. Well, the back pain evolved into some tingling in my left arm, and that scared me a little bit. And then that developed further into some numbness in my left hand. And to give you a little reference, about 10 or 12 years ago, I had some pretty serious neck surgery where I had spinal fusion at C7T1. And those symptoms were reminiscent of what led up to that surgery. So I made it to mile 241, that's Davenport Gap, Interstate 40. And I went into Newport, Tennessee, and I did a double zero at a Hampton Inn there because I just have a whole stack of Hampton or Hilton points. And I thought that a couple of days and some Advil would do the trick. Well, it didn't.
In those 2 days of recuperation, hopefully, you're hoping it would get better, and I kind of know how that works. So I've done that myself in the past. Did it get worse, or did it just stabilize then?
It just stabilized. Okay. It just stabilized. I really couldn't find a position where I could get comfortable, and the numbness would come and go. And I really didn't want to go through surgery again, so I thought it would be prudent to go back and consult with my neurologist.
What did he say to you?
He said, basically, I had a severe case of tendonitis, and that surgery had become somewhat inflamed. So he prescribed some prednisone injections and physical therapy sessions.
Okay. So did he say straight away you can't go back on trail, or had you already made that decision yourself?
I was hoping that he would say, you know, go back to trail and, you know, suck it up and go back. There's nothing to it. But
he's a doctor.
Because mentally I'm ready to go back. I didn't want to come off, but mentally I'm ready to go back. But a good dose of prudence. We're going to take it easy and rest it and PT and strengthen these neck muscles, shoulder muscles a little bit, and then I'll go back later. I've probably lost the 3 height for 2023, so I want to be really, really slow and careful with this because of my prior history. So I'm planning right now to finish up sometime later this year, Tennessee and North Carolina, then go back next year and pick up somewhere around Damascus.
So when you first wrote to me, this was something you'd gone down the YouTube rabbit hole, as we all do, and you were really excited about the prospects of doing it. You've been in insurance all your life and stuff. And you said, I have 30 pounds of obscenely expensive equipment. So this experience hasn't put you off keeping that obscenely expensive equipment then, has it?
All the obscenely expensive equipment is sitting here in my office. I'm looking at it now as we speak. And I wouldn't change a thing. You know, I had some 10, 12 degree nights going through the Smokies.
Sure.
And it performed just great. I wouldn't say I was toasty warm, but I wasn't cold. So I've got a lot of confidence in my equipment. It's just the 63-year-old body had a hiccup and I need to give it some attention.
Yeah. And looking back then on the hike you've done, you said 200, you've gone from Springer to the end of the Smokies. So if you were to look back and say, there's 3 highlights, what would you say those highlights were? Were they general highlights, or were there specific times?
there were some specific times. There was a night that I spent with some people in the Carter Gap shelter, and we just had a grand old time just telling stories and talking, and that was a highlight. Albert Mountain was a highlight, you know, making it to 100 miles and making it up to the top of the mountain. And then probably the walk across Fontana Dam and up to Shuckstack Tower. That was a really good stretch. And that was probably the last good day of weather I had, actually.
Wow. And when did you start noticing you had the problem? Did the problem I think you said it developed in the Smokies. Did you notice it, and did you recognize it was maybe related to that fusion?
I really didn't start connecting the dots until later on in the Smokies. I just thought, hey, you know, you're old and decrepit and you have some back problems. So
I resemble that remark, by the way.
many of us do. It happens to the best of us. I started noticing the pain probably around the Russell Field shelter, but I really didn't connect the dots until later. And by the time I started the descent out of the Smokies, it was really starting to bother me. And my intent was to spend the night at Standing Indian Hostel and then go on. But it was like, I really need to take some time off and nurse this. So I caught a ride into Newport.
So you're off now, and you're firstly, thank you for coming on to tell us about this, because I know it can't be easy. It's something you've been really looking forward to, and looking back on the email originally, you were so looking forward to it as well. So you've obviously taken good things from the experience, which is great as well. How are you feeling about it? Are you feeling what's the word for it? Are you feeling resigned? Are you feeling philosophical, or are you feeling pissed off?
I'm beating up on myself for putting this trip off for so many years. I probably should have done it when I was younger, but hey, in retrospect, you know, we get a lot of clarity. Beating up on myself, but say, hey, the hike's not over. I just won't do it in 1 year. I'll just have to be more prudent about how I do it. I probably won't be a through hiker, but my goal is still to be a 2,000 miler. I still fully intend to hike this trail. I'll just have to take different tactics about reaching that objective.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's a good attitude. I've been lucky enough to do it, to finish it a couple of times. I know I would not have been as gracious as you are about it. I would have been so pissed. Which is one of the reasons I didn't go for a third time, because I thought I've done, had two successes. The chance of getting a third success is pretty remote. So.
Well, I guess, Steve, that's the stoic coming out in me. You know, you just kind of take your circumstances and you adapt and overcome.
Yeah.
As an afterthought, I do want to say that in the Smokies, I spent one night with one of the Ridge Runners up there. And I don't think we're supposed to use their names, but the Ridge Runner on the southern end of the Smokies is just this outstanding young man who was just all full of common sense. And I just really appreciated the advice and counsel that he gave to me and also to the other hikers. I think in Russell Field Shelter, no, it was in Spence. Yes, Russell Field Shelter, we had 14 people in a 12-person shelter that night, and it was just stacked. And
quite roomy then. Really
really. You know, we were in there like sardines. But he was really just a stabilizing factor in that shelter. Not that we really needed it, but I just want to compliment the Ridge Runners.
Do you know? I'm glad you said that. You know, I people thank the people who provide trail magic. People thank Trail Angels and so on, but Ridge Runners rarely get a thing, and obviously the volunteers do the work, but the Ridge Runners are remarkable, aren't they? The way in which they
yes.
kind of work it out. They work out, they read the room very, very well, I found. And I certainly appreciate them, and they are definitely underappreciated. So if there's a Ridge Runner out there, I'd love to have one of you, because I know people listen to the show, so I'd love to have one of you let me know if you're prepared to come on. I'd love to talk to you about Ridge Running as well. Well, look, thanks for saying that, firstly. Secondly, thanks for being part of the Mighty Blue Class of 23. And thirdly, you know, if you do go back, let me know and we'll just carry on with progress and we'll talk about how things have gone. And, you know, hopefully you can get this done.
Yeah, I will do it, Steve. Thank you for having me on the show. No one is more disappointed right now than I am, but I hope I didn't disappoint anyone else.
The only person that matters whether you can't disappoint anybody else. You've got to disappoint yourself or not. You know, you should be, frankly, you did 240-odd miles. That's a long freaking way. I don't care what anyone says. And you made the effort. So thanks for being on the show. And just let's say, stay in touch and we'll catch up again soon. Okay?
Roger that.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. So, two of our three today are no longer going on a through hike. Sonny listened to his body, thank goodness, and he sensibly accepted his own reality for now. If he gets back on, well, I'm going to be cheering him on, and I hope that we speak again from the trail. Just before we hear from George Stefanos, and then the howl came, thanks this week go to our monthly donors, Alan Troy, Jessica Diaz, and Hugh Ickrath. We also had a generous donation from Scott Martin. Thanks to all of our supporters, you know we could not do this without you. So, then the how came, and George is getting up to speed after his time off the trail at home. He's in his own state of Connecticut as he eases his way back in. I'll see you next week. Tuesday the 9th of August 1983, mile 1386.4. I woke up in time to catch the earliest serving of breakfast at 7 o'clock. All the other through hikers were again there, along with our friend, the priest. Didn't seem to harbour any hard feelings over the fact that none of us joined the order this morning. He chatted away again all through the meal, entertaining us with anecdotes and listening to our stories. He had an amusing touch of naivety about certain matters. At one point during breakfast, he suddenly blurted out, "What happens if you're in a shelter with a queer or like that?" He seemed to think that there are hordes of aggressive homosexuals on the trail, badgering straights for sex. Charlie started hiking at 8 o'clock, just before a lively little thunder shower kicked up. Pete and I waited it out a while before we left. Pete's small transistor radio, on which we heard the forecast, called for widely scattered showers, so we had reason to believe that it would blow over quickly. It did. When it stopped, we were quickly on our way. We were both happy that Crazy left before we did. After only one night, Pete was already tired of listening to his tall tales, and I had heard about all I could stand. As we were walking, we discussed Charlie's stories. Pete asked, "Doesn't he listen to what he's saying? Doesn't he know what an arsehole he makes out of himself every time he opens his mouth?" We then proceeded to tell each other stories, such as the time I hiked 72 miles in 3 hours over Roan and Hunt Mountains in Tennessee. Charlie entertained us more in remembrance than he did at any time when he was with us. This morning's portion of the Appalachian Trail was several brief road walks connected by short stretches of woodland path. One of the dirt roads it followed was a portion of the old post road between Albany and New York City, dating back before the Revolutionary War. Part of the woodland hiking today included a stretch on an old mine railroad bed from the Civil War era. Although spectacular scenery was lacking, there was a lot of history along the trail today, and I enjoyed it. We ran into Charlie on the second road walk of the morning. Don't ask me how we caught up to such an amazing hiker so quickly, despite his 45-minute head start on us. No doubt he was giving his thumb a rest in preparation for his next 50-mile day. Fortunately, he spent relatively little time entertaining us with his fantastic stories. As I've already mentioned, he's an amusing and entertaining guy when he's not piling on the bullshit. He was an engaging storyteller. He wasn't a bad hiker either. Had he not at some point given in to some moment of weakness and stuck out his thumb the first time, he undoubtedly could have legitimately hiked the AT. He seemed to be in some strange, pathetic form of denial towards these incidents. Out of the blue, he would launch into stories about how all the other hikers he met were jealous of his hiking prowess and would accuse him of hitchhiking around portions of the trail. Then the fantasy hike tales would come flooding out. It wasn't so much the stories themselves that were annoying as much as the pathological persistence with which he kept spinning them. Sometimes it was hard to figure out who he was really trying to convince. To his credit, Pete seemed to sense this too, and neither he nor I ever questioned Mike's illusions openly. We did, however, occasionally quietly entertain ourselves and each other by remembering some completely imaginary feature on some section of trail Charlie claimed to have hiked over on one of his marathons and watching him squirm and contort reality as he joined us in these reminiscences. At about 12:30, we reached the end of the third and longest road walk of the day, a 2.75-mile stretch along paved and dirt roads. A state park campsite was just up the road from the point where the Appalachian Trail turned into the woods. We decided to have lunch there. It was a good decision. The site featured a hand-cranked pump which poured out cool, delicious water. The water situation is looking up since we crossed the Hudson River, and the trail has also taken on a new complexion. It's mellowed a great deal. The steep climbs are much shorter, and there are not nearly as many. Things in general seem to be on the upswing now as I near New England. Even the weather's better. It was much cooler today. The sun came out about mid-morning, bringing with it a memorably fine afternoon. Things got a little strange during lunch. Just before the campsite, we had passed the entrance to a summer camp. As we were relaxing with our meal, we were suddenly surrounded by a group of about 15 teenage girls returning from a hike. Within seconds, we were surrounded by a wall of sound. They were all firing questions at us, talking at the same time, 15 separate, simultaneous conversations. It was rather challenging trying to follow all those individual torrents of words. The situation had its humorous side, but it was exhausting. The only one who thoroughly enjoyed the experience was Crazy Charlie. He had a whole new, rather gullible audience for his stories. The funniest moment occurred when one of the girls asked the three of us who was the best hiker. Pete and I glanced at each other in anticipation. Charlie did not let us down. He instantly and cheerfully informed them that it was he. Pete and I just looked at each other and laughed. Nevertheless, we did keep silent and allow Charlie to have his little moment. Things finally settled down. Charlie and the girls had a delightful time talking over, around and through each other's conversations while I chatted with the older girl who was leading the group. She was close to my age and possessed the ability to hold a conversation where the participants take turn in talking and listening. I felt for her. After a few minutes in the middle of that uproar, my nerves were thoroughly jangled. This poor girl would almost have to eat Valium like candy in order to cope with that day after day. The next 3.5 miles were an easy walk through pleasant forests with no distant views. The Appalachian Trail then crossed to New York Route 301 and ascended a very rocky trail alongside Canopus Lake. After a couple more miles, we stood on a rock outcrop overlooking a public beach below. A very steep side trail, virtually a rock climb, led down towards the beach. We dropped our packs and headed down off the mountain. Our objective was a snack bar adjacent to the beach. Sadly, we arrived at 4:30, just after the grill had closed. I had to content myself with nothing more than a huge icy Coke, 3 ice cream sandwiches, and a bag of potato chips. I'm becoming inured to tragedy, so I was a brave little soldier. While eating, I tried to call home in order to inform my family when to meet me in Kent, Connecticut with my next supply package. But a phone company strike was in progress. A recorded message said that an operator would eventually come on the line and put my call through if it was urgent, but I was not in the mood for dealing with that type of a hassle. It was 5 o'clock and I still had 5 miles to hike today. The trail up to the summit of Shenandoah Mountain was a breeze. The open summit featured the first real views of the entire day. We sat up there for a half hour, enjoying the sunshine, cool breezes, and some rare haze-free vistas. I was the last to leave, heading down the mountain at 6 o'clock with 3 miles remaining to tonight's destination, Ralph's Peak Hiker's Cabin. The path down was the best maintained trail I'd yet seen in New York and New Jersey. I made tracks. It was the best hiking I've managed since my layoff. I arrived at the cabin at 7 o'clock. It felt great to move like that again, especially at the end of a long day. I can't say enough about this cabin. The 2 southbounders at Graymore Monastery told us about this place, and I'm very happy they did. The club that maintains this section of the Appalachian Trail, the Ralph's Peak Hikers, has restored an old farmhouse and furnished it with beds, a kitchen table, and various other amenities. A caretaker who stops by every day to clean up leaves water, fruit, today a bowl of delicious apples, and goodies, soda and pretzels, which are all free. They do accept donations, so I gladly kicked in a few bucks. I'm told that a well will soon be operating and the place will even have electricity. As an added touch of thoughtfulness, the club leaves a bicycle outside for any hiker who wants to make the 1 mile trip to a nearby grocery store. A man named John Perry was visiting the cabin with his wife. He maintains a section of the Appalachian Trail up ahead in Connecticut, and he comes here often in order to meet the through hikers who will soon be hiking through his section. A fervent supporter of the trail, he carries a register which he asks all through hikers he meets to sign. The section he maintains is one of the toughest in Connecticut to keep up, because 2 miles of it runs through dense weeds along the Housatonic River. He's one of the most enthusiastic and conscientious volunteers I've ever met. With dedicated people like him on the job, I get the feeling that the Appalachian Trail is going to continue to flourish. Through hikers must hike a lot of miles every day, day after day. The experience makes us as a group some of the biggest babies in the world when the trail is not laid out and maintained perfectly. We all left Springer Mountain, constantly whining and complaining about the performance of some of the clubs who maintain the trail. As we hike along, we meet more and more of their hard-working members, and most of us gradually change our tunes. I cannot understand the few that do not. How can you meet people like John Perry and not grow to respect the difficult and thankless job that these people do, donating their time and labour to the Appalachian Trail? Wednesday, the 10th of August, 1983, mile 1411.3. I left Ralph's Peak Hiker's Cabin this morning at 7:45 with Crazy Charlie. Pete was a few minutes behind us. After that little burst at the end of the day yesterday, I finally knew I was back into hiking form, so I spent the day on Charlie's heels, really forcing him to move. After all his big talk, he could not let me leave him in the dust. It was fine for him to tell Pete and me what a good hiker he was when we were too out of shape to make him prove it. Today, I finally felt strong enough to make him sweat. The initial 6 miles were almost all on forest paths, climbing over a couple of mountains with no real views. The trail was well laid out, however, and even contained the first real switchbacks I can remember seeing since Virginia. We had an enjoyable time on the climbs. I hiked them at my good old pace without any rest stops. Charlie was too short of breath to spin any yarns. The next section of trail was a 12-mile road walk. Charlie became desperate enough to suggest to me that we try to hitch a ride over it, but I just laughed. Then he tried to play it off as a joke, so I pretended to believe him. Finally, a day with a high only in the 70s and a low humidity for one of my long road walks. Hell, it felt downright chilly waking up this morning. It was the first real break in the long heat wave since early June. It was a quiet, rural stroll, mostly on small, shady lanes through attractive forests and quiet residential neighbourhoods. About 5 miles into the road walk, we had a little grocery store in the village of Holmes, New York. I bought my usual ice cream and Coke store lunch and threw in a couple of small bags of pistachios for variety. Pete caught up to us during our break at the store. He was also feeling back in form, having recovered from his 8-day layoff, and the two of us gleefully conspired to drive Charlie mercilessly to keep up with us. I am willing to bet money that Charlie hitches ahead tomorrow. Now that Pete and I are both back in shape, he can no longer talk the talk to us without walking the walk. Bon voyage, crazy. About 2 miles from the end of the long road walk, the three of us stopped at a little town park in Pawling, New York, about an hour's drive and 2 or 3 universes removed from New York City. Edward R. Murrow Memorial Park contained a small lake with a tiny beach, a snack bar, and a picnic area. It had been just slightly more than an hour since I had lunch at that little store, so I only managed 2 burgers, 2 orders of fries, and 2 Cokes from the snack bar. I also called home to arrange tomorrow's supply drop. We had 16 miles already under our belts and masses of food as well, so we took an hour break. The local Lions Club was having a picnic, and the day sparkled with perfection. That little patch of manicured green, blue water and cool woods was one of the loveliest spots on earth this afternoon. At 4 o'clock, we were preparing to leave and begin hiking the final 9 miles of the day to Wiley's shelter. Then fate stepped in to delay our departure, as a nice old lady brought us some Coke and potato salad that were left over from the picnic. Although for once food was not high on our list of wants, we had some of that too and sat there chatting with her until 4:30. That extra half hour made it very difficult to get those 9 miles in before dark, especially considering the awesome amount of food I'd just put away in the last few hours. On top of all that, we accepted her invitation to stop by our house, which was a mile ahead, directly on our road walk, and have a cold drink. We didn't leave a house until 6 o'clock, and we still had 8 more miles to go in order to reach the side trail to the shelter, and another half mile on the side trail. About 2 hours of daylight remained. At the house, we learned that it was supposed to rain tonight, so we were determined to make it. The rest of the day was a blur of fast hiking on aching feet. There's nothing like an 8-mile sprint when you've already hiked more than 17 miles that day and personally put away enough food to feed the average Ethiopian family of 12. There was another mile left on roads, followed by a short stretch of trail through fields and woods, then another 20-minute road walk. Finally, the Appalachian Trail re-entered the woods, passing through the Pawling Town Nature Reserve, and stayed on forest trails for most of the final 4.5 miles. Less than a mile from the side trails to the shelter, I crossed a dirt road and met a young couple who were standing outside their house waiting for me. All that fast hiking had finally torn off the 3 remaining toenails from the 9 I'd smashed on Pennsylvania rocks. The limping was slowing me down, and Peter and Charlie were about 5 minutes ahead of me. This couple had offered them water, informing them that the water supply at Wiley's shelter, a stone cistern built to catch rainwater, was, of course, bone dry after 2 months of drought. Pete and Charlie asked them to fill my 6-quarter water bag when I came by, providing the 3 of us with water for cooking. They waited, which put a final exclamation point on a day remarkable for the thoughtfulness and kindness of the people we encountered. On the other hand, wasn't that swell of Charlie and Pete, leaving me to carry the weight of all our water at the end of a grueling evening. Thanks, chums. I arrived at the shelter at 8:30, walking the last mile in the dark. For some reason, nobody felt much like eating dinner. We lay there reminiscing about our day of legendary gluttony as the first raindrops began tapping against the tin shelter roof. Tuesday, the 11th of August, 1983, mile 1420, Kent. It was cool and damp with constant showers today, but nothing too heavy. I set out this morning at 8:30. As usual, I was the last one to leave the shelter. I'm growing tired of hanging out with all these morning people. They make me feel decadent. The first mile of the day's hike was on a forest path. Swarms of biting deer flies harassed me relentlessly during that stretch. It was a relief to come out on the beginning of a 3-mile road walk and leave the little bastards behind me. But the escape was only temporary. I caught up with Charlie and Pete about 2 miles into the road walk. They had stopped to talk to that couple with the nice dog who kept ruining my sleep in Northern Virginia. They turned out to be okay, at least when you're not trying to sleep in the same shelter. The rains came on steadily just as we completed the final New York road walk and headed up the trail over Shaktikot Mountain. It was the beginning of the first all-day rain I have encountered since the Blue Ridge south of Shenandoah. Everything since then has been brief summer thunder showers or thunderstorms brewed by the sizzling, soggy air. Despite the rain, hiking was fairly pleasant today. It was nice to feel a bit chilly again while backpacking. I would have enjoyed the trail immensely were it not for the most persistent and obnoxious deer flies on the entire Appalachian Trail. Swirling masses of them surrounded us whenever we were in the woods. Pete and Charlie were eaten alive, but I kept my trusty bandana in hand to chase them off when they tried to land. Once my bandana began soaking up the rain, it became heavy and lethal. I killed two. Warding off their constant attacks had become so annoying that perhaps my mind slipped a little bit over the edge. I didn't wipe their blood from my legs. Instead, I left it as a warning to their friends. Do you feel lucky today, punk? Their unnerving persistence placed those two flight executions among the most satisfying moments of my entire Appalachian Trail hike. The first few miles of Connecticut Trail were typically rough New England trail, but there were good views through the rain from some ledges called Indian Rocks from the summit of Mount Algo. Descending to a paved state road, we left the Appalachian Trail to walk into the town of Kent. Thanks to our long day yesterday, we only had 9 miles to cover in the rain today. My early departure from the trail at Greenwood Lake, New York, had eliminated Kent from my planned list of trail towns, but my mother wanted to meet me here at the closest approach to the Appalachian Trail to my hometown, so I agreed. It wasn't a bad idea, at any rate, for me to be carrying a rather light load of supplies those first tricky days back on the trail. Today's cold rain made the extra stop more worthwhile. Although I rather enjoyed the long-lost feeling of being chilly, I can always manage to do without the thrill of being damp and clammy. A hot shower tonight and warm clothes for the morning was an attractive prospect. I arrived in Kent at 1 o'clock. My mother was 4 hours late with my supplies, so I had a very large lunch and sat down out of the rain beneath the awning of a laundromat to wait. A muddy, dripping anomaly amongst the upscale shops and shoppers of a tidy little mall in an affluent western Connecticut village, I felt nothing but contentment. My heart and soul once more belonged to the Appalachian Trail and my dream of Katahdin. My return to the trail had come with a restored sense of peace and patience. I enjoyed drifting through the quiet forests and villages of eastern New York and the anticipation of my imminent return to the highlands of the Appalachian Trail. Now back in southern New England, the rugged mountains of Vermont, New Hampshire and Maine loom ever closer. It's not quite the middle of August, and I have up to 2 months to hike the final third of the Appalachian Trail and beat the first snows to the top of Mount Katahdin. Barring utter disaster, one of the cool, clear autumn days of early October will see me standing atop Baxter Peak at the end of a very long road. 718.5 miles to go.